week than a home, anyway. I wasn't sad to leave, only to have to move. There were 100-something units in the whole building, so for me it was Eloise at the Plaza, never really a home. Work was my home, and I'd spent the last 7 years or so living in a money drain. When I wasn't worrying, I brushed off stress with delusion, denial, and faith. I liked the Gilded apartment, though. Nadine, the previous owner, was into remodeling, especially the trim and the molding, to get it to resemble what it was originally. I liked the apartment not filled, and thinking about the history. Emily Post, who lived around the corner, as well as Edith Wharton, and Mark Twain, whose apartments I'd pass every time I walked down 10th Street. Nadine was a class act and had a vintage bicycle from the 40s leaned against the wall when the apartment was staged for sale. He took me out to dinner and left the bicycle as a gift. I ended up giving the bicycle to someone who fell in love with it. I don't remember who it was, but I'd been thrown in the air by a bike messenger the last time I rollerbladed, so my time of feeling safe on wheels had ended. My friend Rob Roth was stuck in the middle of a move, too. We'd met a decade before. He directed a show at Abrams Art Center on the Lower East Side, where the singer Theo Kogan performed with a projected image over herself as she stood still on a volcano made of TVs that were all turned to static. It had an eerie effect as she sang songs with the spirit of herself in front of her lip-syncing. Rob wasn't actually moving apartments, but the apartments were being moved around him as he was possibly or probably being rent-evicted by his landlord, a slimeball, who was now in jail. And if you saw a picture of him, you'd say rat landlord, who was that archetypal. The building was being renovated to up the rent for the mostly younger people whose parents foot the bill. And most everyone moved out because the remodeling drove them crazy or they'd gotten bought out. The noise was one thing, and the construction debris floating everywhere was another. It's hard to have a good day when your front door is covered in plastic, like a biological warfare zone or something out of a Tarkovsky film, something that screams, "I'm contaminated," when you arrive at the door. It was Hispanic families and artists who stood their ground and were able to hold on to their rent-stabilized apartments. About 10 out of 60 tenants remained. The remaining tenants would watch construction workers take away the structural beams outside their windows and wonder if the work being done would cave in their entire building. The pipes that flooded Rob's bathroom had him feeling gaslit. Was it done on purpose, or were the workers simply too inept to repair the pipes above him when they turned the water main downstairs? Did the rat man landlord turn it on himself, or was there just a real rat who needed a bath? Rats are smart and they're dirty. Or if you're thinking positive, was it all just a way to get close to his neighbors who were all going through the same thing? The mantle of the fake fireplace on the ground floor, which had served as a junk store and resembled Christmas all year long, had held books that had been left by neighbors, along with old costumes and a pair of buffalo horns that Rob took for his place. Now they demolished that, and there was nothing to leave the neighbors. So say bye-bye to your found treasures and that sweet reciprocity. It's easier to throw it in the dumpster directly outside anyway. Who cares? No one. This pissed both of us off, and we called it evil. Our found pieces of furniture in the sidewalks of the city were some of our most cherished possessions because they had meaning. Rob's dad was a policeman in the 70s in the Bronx, which makes me think of that movie Dog Day Afternoon. Rob's a performance artist and dresses like a wolf and sings songs by the Smiths at cabarets and theaters and even at weddings. The wolf's name is Craig, and he's pretty starved but likes to sing. Craig is Rob's protest, like Pacino's Attica, Attica, when he leaves that bank. The protest of the disenfranchised, of not only prisoners, but gays and artists and anyone left in the margins the city has neglected, like the people without money. It takes about an hour for Rob's transformation because he has to glue fur to his face as well as put on fake nails. We had some fun moments of inspiration where we talked about making short films in the building, but it was better left as inspiration. Why give your head more apocalyptic images to fit into your dreams? We both already had dust up our noses. And in the darkened underpass, I thought, oh God, my chances come at last. "There is a light that never goes out" by the Smiths is one of the best songs ever. Not appropriate for a plane ride, but So I moved out of the Gold Coast to rent my friends Mindy and Tony's apartment in the West Village. They had two kids, Billy and Emma, who were 4 and 6 at the time. And since the townhouse they were in belonged to Tony's mom, Marcia, it was okay for them to put a spiral staircase in the corner and make a pop-up on the roof as their master bedroom. They were busting out of the place, and it was an obstacle course of toys and sippy cups, and they could afford to move, so they did. But they didn't want Marcia to be alone and couldn't think of anyone besides me that she could tolerate having around. Marcia is a born and bred West Village New Yorker. She's Jewish and looks like Woody Allen's twin sister. She's just as diminutive in size and wears loose khakis and starched white shirts and glasses. She doesn't care for his movies and couldn't care less about his personal life. She's from the none of my business generation and was a moldy fig in her teen years. That's what a group of particular jazz enthusiasts called themselves in Manhattan at that time. They liked Dixieland jazz, pure jazz, not the Duke Ellington stuff. Marcia has distinct tastes, is sharp as a tack, and lives a full life. Betting on the horses during the day, stopping at her favorite butcher, Florence Meat Market, going to the stupid market, which she calls the local grocery store, taking her private yoga class as a cigarette burns in an ashtray. She loves a good drink, good movies, PBS, opera, and ballet, and admittedly has no sense for decorating. She's an excellent cook and tells wonderful stories, even when they veer toward the medical, colonoscopies, her gynecologist, and her removed breast. I adore her. We had a fun time on the Cape after her day of screaming at the television to cheer the horses and going outside to read or stare at the sailboats. "There's the view," she'd say in a way that made us both laugh. At night, she'd pass me the pint of coffee-flavored Häagen-Dazs saying, "I know you want another bite, Parker Posey." We like the same treats or goodies, like Australian black licorice, turtles, chocolate almond bark, anything coffee. Turtles are like millionaires, chocolate, caramel, and pecans. I'd move in easily as a surrogate family member and tenant, or so I thought and hoped. Mindy had moved into my rent-controlled place in Chelsea in the early 2000s, so it was an even trade in my book. There'd have to be work done, so I hired an architect, as work would have to be done by a professional. I'd heard about the mouse problem over the years. Mouse problem sounds so much better than infestation, doesn't it? The kitchen was cockamamie, with the fridge door opening the wrong way toward the enormous butcher block island that made me think of a gurney. Yes, take me away. Tony was a deadhead and even had his own restaurant in Seattle in the 90s. His stories could fill a podcast. I broke the wall in the kids' room to have more of an open loft and knocked out a closet in the middle of the apartment to get sunlight from both sides of the building. The man who came to repair the floors kept singing "Under the Boardwalk," and when I joined in, it got out of hand. He cornered me singing the song as I was standing on the ledge of a window trying to pull the old blinds hardware off that had been there since the 60s. I remember one insane moment of trying to leave the apartment, pulling myself away as he was trying to grab my hands to dance, and I was instead snapping my fingers and harmonizing so loudly and off-key, thinking I could stop this, but enjoyed it, sort of. Opening the door to leave, singing, "Oh, Mandy, well, you came and you gave without taking." He liked the songs heard in subway stations, the songs that have a hard time leaving your head. I'd sing these subway songs when Rob and I made many trips to IKEA and drove us both crazy. We called IKEA the purgatory of home improvement because what you'd purchase guaranteed many returns, like atonement. My entire kitchen came from there. It was around my 5th or 6th trip, and an employee there who'd seen me days before said, "I never want to see you again," when I left, and I shouted, "Me neither," and skated my cart out of there. I saw her the next day, and when she saw me coming, shouted, "I thought I said I never wanted to see you again," and I told her I was there to make up. The renovation seemed simple enough at the outset, but were fraught with obstacles, too boring for me to go into or even want to remember. My architect, Michael, was baffled by all the legalese stuff, permits, or whatever drama or loopholes were thrown our way. I felt like I'd paid him mostly to handle me. I'd met another architect recently who, when I asked what his job was like, said, "It's mainly getting the wives to do what the husbands want." Ha, 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 ha. So funny. A director I'd worked with, James, let me stay in the townhouse he'd bought as an investment, which was conveniently close to Marsha's. It was stark and dark in there, but rich and hazy, where an oil painting of a stormy, mythical English countryside hung in the dark kitchen. The bathroom downstairs was tiny and painted dark teal and lacquered. The toilet flusher was a small brass button on the wall that was difficult to see from the light of the brass-flapped sconces that framed the mirror. I'd press the button thinking I was detonating a bomb or opening an escape hatch or hoping the wall would move and get me to Narnia. It didn't, but the gray-tinted mirror granted a dark, ageless glow. The master bathroom had a 70s Hollywood Regency vibe to it and reminded me of The Shining. Mirrors everywhere, in octagonal marble tiles, and a bathtub so big I'd have to brace myself with one arm to shave my legs. I pictured myself going down a drain. I'd make my way to Marsh's in the mornings to oversee the work once it had started and called Rob to share that I was walking in my slippers down the sidewalk. He'd tell me how a jar fell on his head as he sat on the floor putting on his face fur for Craig. The gash in his head was maybe a sign to stop performing, and as he tormented himself over it, I'd encourage him by saying, "No, you were just in character. What do you expect as Craig? He's a mess, but you're not." We were both messes, and we'd catch each other's heads like they were lids flying off a full-speed blender. We were in tandem, though. Moving is one of the top three most stressful things you can do, everyone kept telling me, and when you hear that from friends who don't have time to help, it rings even more true. Moving is one of the top three most stressful things you can do. It's up there with death and divorce. I'd hear over and over again. Moving is both death and divorce. The time you spent in that home dies, and you divorce most of your belongings. Friends would pop by to escort me and the belongings that survived the divorce and help push one of those wheeled carts through Washington Square Park to Marsha's. I wanted to keep organized and didn't want to unpack a bunch of cardboard boxes that would have me feeling both empty and overwhelmed. So I made several trips to unload things by hand. Marsha had gone to Cape Cod and we were waiting for permits for demolition to start, and I arranged my things nicely in Tony's old room. My prince, as Marsha refers to him, always touching her hand to her heart whenever she says his name. The renovations will be done when Marsha comes back in October. Mindy, Tony, and I were chanting like a mantra. Tony had terrible stomach problems that were more than just lactose intolerance and was getting it all checked out. Moving is emotional. I decided to leave for just 10 days to do Kogonada's movie Columbus with John Cho and Haley Lou Richardson. Kogonada, with his mononymous name, had written about film in magazines like Filmmaker, and I'd seen his video essays on Vimeo, which were so beautiful they took my breath away. They were edited composites of directors he admired, like Ozu and Kubrick, Soderbergh and Linklater, seen through his artful eye and understanding of cinema. He was so inspired by the mecca of modern architecture in Columbus, Indiana, that he'd based the film there. I'd never been, or at least not that I remembered, and kept calling it Illinois. The demolition, the noise, in the new place would start while I was away, and I decided if the cost of the moving trucks matched what I'd get paid for the part, I'd consider it an equal trade. It did, so I did it. Situations had to have balance, had to be just, or I may have cracked. So when the part came, I looked at it as meaningful help. I'd play Eleanor, an architect and writer who was assisting her mentor, Jay Yong Lee, while he was giving a lecture in Columbus. She spent her early 20s studying with him in Seoul and lived with his family. Kogonada said she was the bridge or in between to two men, a daughter or creative mistress to Jay Yong Lee, and for his son Jin, his first love, who wasn't his mother, and sister figure. The different kinds of love we have for each other branch out to affect the lives of everyone around us. Trees don't compete for sunlight, like we learned at school, or fight to get taller. They collaborate and exist harmoniously, naturally. That's how they grow. In the film, within the frame, Kogonato placed architecture as if it were a character. Mid-century architecture had so much promise and optimism, the placement of buildings on the ground in relation to nature and to the space already held in the surrounding environment, the lines of symmetry drawing out vertically and horizontally into space. The harmony becomes alive when you participate, when you can stand inside the space and feel it. Haley Lu's character Casey would awaken Jin to those thoughts again. Casey represented Eleanor 20 years ago, before her marital responsibilities and the anguish that comes with maturity. Within the story of the film and the characters' relationships, Kogonato wanted to explore what he called the burden of absence that children carry in regards to their parents. The first scene takes place at the famous modernist masterpiece home of J. Irwin Miller and Xenia Simons Miller, built by Eero Saarinen with interiors designed by Alexander Girard and Dan Kiley, known as the Miller House and Garden. The Miller family was responsible for commissioning the best architects in the world at this time and paying contractors to build their designs. It was their philanthropy, as well as the Cummins Engine Company, that stamped the small town of 45,000 people with over 50 modernist buildings. The first shot was at the Miller House and Garden, where I run to greet my mentor, Jae Yong Lee, as he's taking in the view of the massive east lawn framed with weeping beech trees. It was raining that day and foreshadowed the sadness to come. The next scene, I'd be on the phone with my husband, and Jae Yong Lee would collapse. I would get to drop my umbrella and run to him, admitting him into the hospital. I'd get in touch with Jin to have him fly to Columbus, where we'd sit at a bar while I tried to temper his resentments toward his father. Why be there for his dad when his dad was never there for him? We hadn't seen each other in over a decade, and our relationship was still like family. I'd guide him, like an all-loving mother, to stay, like a sister who's always right. He's your father, Jin. I'd get to express my own grief and frustration with my dad's prostate cancer of over 20 years, which was getting worse now. His bones were brittle, and a tumor was bumping a screw from his hip operation. His charm had pushed its edge into being erratically demanding, and projections too strong for me to break through. I'd be told I wasn't listening to him, and I don't think you understand. My twin brother and I were 14 again in his eyes, and our issues with Dad would have to be resolved internally. The burden of absence active in both of us, and the situation demanding lightness and humor. He'd always been a wonderful narcissist and a star patient to his doctors at Sloan Kettering. One got so worked up that she finally shouted at him, "You use your cancer to get attention." My dad thought this was hysterical in the way that funny things are true, and savored the extra attention. My mom, relaying the story, adorned in her Ann Taylor and gold chains, rolled her eyes and shrugged up, "What are you gonna do? How many more seats in the audience need to be filled?" My brother was carrying so much of the burden down south and reaching his limit with the demands placed on him. He and his wife have 3 kids, and when Dad would call at 7:30 in the morning with a craving for an Egg McMuffin, it didn't bode well. I was concerned for his health, both of theirs, all of theirs, body, mind, and spirit. Making a scotch for Dad when he was on chemo was painful. I would place my father in the hospital and bring him flowers and hug my brother. I'd get up the nerve to get on wheels again and ride a rental bike to Jill's Diner to eat breakfast, where the small town talk of agriculture sounded like radio. "All the rain we've had is bad for the onions. How are your onions this summer?" I savored the talk as much as the old-timey breakfast of scrambled eggs and grits and buttered white toast, and a minister I met there even bought my breakfast as a welcome to town. I rode my bike around Henry Moore's large arch sculpture, which stood outside the main library, designed by I.M. Pei, which was across the street from the first Christian church, built by Eliel Saarinen. I'd sit in my car waiting to take Casey under my wing, and away from her home to study architecture herself. The metal spire of the North Christian Church, designed by Eliel's son, Eero Saarinen, was almost 200 feet high and stood in the frame between Casey and Jin. Haley's performance in the car as she poured out her grief was spectacular and human. I stayed up too late on my last day of working, having drinks at a bar downtown they'd kept open for us privately. John Cho was too recognizable from Star Trek and fans were getting rowdy. We partied with Casey's mom in the film, Michelle Forbes, Miksha, and shared war stories about being women in show business. I missed my flight out of Columbus, thinking it was at 1 o'clock instead of 11 o'clock, and would receive an email with the news that my mentor in college, Joe Stockdale, had passed that very day. A line I'd said to Jin the first day of work, how his father meant everything to me, expressed itself again, there in the airport lounge. The paramenopausal puppet troupe came back to life, speeding their emotions to my awareness and all that pathos. The move to Marshes was emotional. Upheavals happened to the building as well as to the family. Tony had been diagnosed with diverticulitis and was in the hospital while I was shooting Columbus. I came back to a garbage bag of food on the kitchen floor and saw mice scurrying out. He'd been in too much pain to take it downstairs after he emptied the fridge. His old room was packed to the gills with large boxes along with my clothes, which hung in a wardrobe rack, and the plants I'd placed on the bookshelves. We bit our nails for 2 months, hoping Marcia wouldn't mind my things stuffed in Tony's old room. She did, though, and I had to move everything upstairs to collect dust there. I got lost in space, and the offer to play Dr. Smith on Netflix while I was moving some things from the country from the house I'd struggled to keep. I was obsessed with the show as a kid, and would wake up before 6 and watch the static of the TV as it turned to the color bars and the show began. The Robinson family, stranded on their own alien planet. And Dr. Smith, an alien family member. I'd be moving to Vancouver in 6 weeks for what would be 8 months. And get paid to pay homage to a character and show that I loved. A few days before Christmas, the last ceiling patch was spackled and sanded. My nose had stopped dripping like a faucet, and steroids had gotten rid of an earache that had me truly unbalanced. I brought Marcia upstairs to show her my projector screen. We both loved TCM, and an old movie was on, and she loved the renovations. I ran out to dinner with Rob and afterward would finally have a quiet night in. I started a bath when I got home, and as I waited, Gracie sat with me, and we took in the new view with a sense of peace at last. Until I saw water gushing from under the crack of the bathroom door. I grabbed my blankets and towels and even took off my clothes to throw on the floor. I called Rob as I put on my warm-ups, shaking, my voice small and afraid of getting into trouble. He talked me down and asked if Marcia had called. "Not yet," I said. And then she did. It would be okay in the end, Rob assured me and wished me luck. "Hi, Marcia," I sounded like a child in trouble. "What is happening? Outside my bedroom is dripping." "I'm so sorry, Marcia. The bathtub overflowed," I said it calmly, and then, "I'll be right down." I met her in the living room, and she asked if I was an idiot, and I assured her I wasn't. I was used to my old bathtub, which never overflowed and was louder than the one in the bathroom upstairs and had a thing in it that prevented overflowing. "The chandelier costs a fortune," she wailed. "What about all the African art?" I helped her move an expensive antique table away from the wall. I moved the Chinese porcelain bowl that held her mail and photographs, which were now wet, as she shouted, "My theater tickets are in there and ruined." I moved a large African art mask, as she told me it was worth a fortune and irreplaceable. "And it's Christmas," she shouted. When she asked me again if I was an idiot, I said that I was, as I looked at the wall in front of us, how it was sweating as it produced tears that dripped. I ran upstairs to get more towels, as gentle drops were falling from the flooded ceiling onto Marcia's carpet. "Marcia, I will be here in the summer to oversee repairs to whatever damage is done." "I don't know if you will even be living here next summer," she said as she walked into her bathroom for more towels. I went to bed wondering about my move. Had I made a choice in hopes of a fantasy? Would the reality of it be a nightmare? Was I living in the right place? My friends had been concerned, and it was kind of a crazy thing to do. I'm surprised I fell asleep and slept through the night. The next day, I called my dad to tell him the whole story, and we laughed hard about it. I called him on Christmas to tell him how Marcia had offered me a hot toddy for my cold the night before, as well as Yukonuba, and how I said, I don't think dog food will help me with this, but maybe you mean echinacea? We laughed hard about that one, too. It sounded like Marcia was the perfect landlady for me. 20. Master of Storms. I met Woody Allen for Shadows and Fog and Bullets Over Broadway back in the 90s. Julia Taylor has been his casting director for years, and he's never liked the process of meeting actors for roles, so it's up to her to choose a handful of people she thinks are right for whatever part in whatever film he's working on that year. She and I had been in Krakow, Poland together as judges at a film festival, so that's how I landed in the right timing for A Rational Man. It's really like that game in Vegas with that wheel that spins and the ball lands in the right place. I don't even know the name of that thing. It was time to reinvent and get creative. I met Camille Paglia when we were on the Joy Behar show, and she gave me her book, Glittering Images. A year later, her publicist proposed we make something together. We were emailing, trying to figure out what that could be. Something surreal and absurd, or meta. A walk-and-talk film at first, where Camille talks about art and culture and architecture, and then we have dinner at a restaurant and talk some more. Like my dinner with Andre. We'd reference Ingmar Bergman's film Persona, which Camille knew inside out. It inspired the title of her famous book, Sexual Personae. And maybe Anna Kendrick would play a younger actress I'm haunted by. We'd set a scene on stage where I'd performed the Greek tragedy, Medea, with Anna in the wings as my understudy. Camille would be sitting in the audience as a critic, critiquing both Anna and me as we took turns playing the part. The idea of doing an experimental film kept me entertained enough not to obsess about never working again as an actor. I thought about teaching acting class at NYU and visited the acting department, assisting a class, which was fun. My friend Jen Ruff was an editor and teacher there and collaborating with me on the Camille project, and I took her to Poland as my guest at the festival. We'd take boat rides around Krakow with Juliet and fellow jurors and watch films during the day and hobnob with journalists and filmmakers at night. There's so much history dating back to the Stone Age, and then there are all these Baroque-style basilicas and cathedrals. It's so gothic. The sights had us looking up and down wherever we walked, which slowed us down. The nuns from all the churches around the neighborhood had an easier time of it, and I even saw a few of them walking briskly, looking at their iPhones. I met Benedict Cumberbatch at the hotel before he ran through a crowd of screaming fangirls to his limo and before he was honored for his work in independent cinema that night. I had trouble identifying his work in independent film, but gushed about his work as Sherlock Holmes and racked my brain briefly to remember an actress I had worked with 20 years earlier, a friend of his he'd mentioned. He was wearing a beautiful silver gray suit that was perfectly tailored and dashed quickly out, leaving me bewildered and a little embarrassed and feeling on the spot. Juliet brought me in to meet Woody the week we got back. Everyone knows you meet Woody with one foot out the door and that meeting him could last just a few minutes and that the amount of time was no indication of whether or not you'd get cast. I knew the part I was up for was a teacher, so I dressed appropriately and made my way to his office and screening room uptown. It's in a doorman building with a small lobby, and I got there right on time so I could breeze through the casting office and into the screening room where he was standing and waiting to the left. Juliet was next to him and introduced us. I smiled because I'm a fan and shook his hand. Juliet's luggage got lost on the way home from Poland, so we made small talk about that and about Krakow, about the salt mines he wouldn't be able to visit because of his claustrophobia. He said something like, Juliet wanted us to meet because I'm doing a film in Rhode Island and there's a part you could be right for. He said he wanted to meet me to make sure I wasn't crazy. I laughed and assured him that I wasn't. He went on to say that the movie was starring Joaquin Phoenix. I gushed over Joaquin, calling him soulful and poetic, to which Woody simply said, uh-oh. Since my foot was out the door, it was easy to get out and make my way with the rest of my day. I got feedback later on that the meeting went well, that Woody was engaged in the 4 minutes we spent talking. I'd wait to see if I fit his vision. I got a call the next day while I was in the dog room with Gracie, and my manager asked casually if I was going to be home from noon to 2 o'clock, because that was when the sides, as the pages in a script are called, would be delivered. We laughed and I actually started crying because that ball on that wheel had landed in that thing in Vegas. Roulette is what it's called. I then dropped Gracie back at the apartment and walked to Trader Joe's for some groceries, and when I returned, my sides were hand-delivered to me. There was a cover letter describing the character of Rita, a science teacher, flirt, in an unhappy marriage, and loose. I didn't receive a letter that flattered me in any way as an actress, but maybe that was some kind of tactic. The title of the movie was Wasp, and I smiled when I read the side pages where Rita referred to herself as the original lapsed Catholic. How did he know that I was a lapsed Catholic? The pages were terrific, and he'd captured my voice so distinctly that I'd wondered if he'd written the pages the night before specifically for my cadence. I began to study the lines, to find clues to the character. The writing was so witty and natural, but that's all I could glean when I put my detective hat on. What the tone was, I had no idea. Nor did I know what happened in the plot, or if it was a darker film like Interiors, or lighter like Bananas. I got one clue wrong off the bat, though. It wasn't a Woody Allen film about white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. WASP was an acronym for Woody Allen Summer Project. It's hard to see the forest for the trees, but I'd be in the thick of Woody's Island soon and game for it all. I broke my wrist a few weeks later and would have to be a part of Rita. There's something that's said in acting class when a mistake happens. Use it. There are no addendums to that saying, like, even if it's your right hand that's needed for everything. So I rolled with the punches and held back tears in my costume fitting as I crept my newly splinted wrist through shirt sleeves and groaned at myself in Susie Benzinger's wardrobe mirror about how puffy those pain pills and the ice cream I'd eaten to go with them had made me. Susie could sense my downward spiral and said something about Woody saying I had nice skin, which I didn't believe for a second. I left 2 weeks later for camera tests and production to find a place to live in Providence or Newport where we were shooting. I took my truck, a Nissan Frontier my dad had given me from his dealership, and Gracie spent 5 weeks with Rob. I met Emma Stone in the hair and makeup trailer, and she was open, funny, warm, and bright, genuinely supportive and even respectful. Having started Magic in the Moonlight, she understood my nervousness. And if you're around the right people, that energy can be close to fun, and it was with her. Camera tests were held in a huge soundstage, and offices like accounting and production were off to the sides. Our wardrobes were in racks with partition sheets in a dingy room. I passed Joaquin barreling out the double doors, so we hugged our introduction and admitted to our sweating armpits and nerves and laughed as we got called impatiently to go our separate ways, him to change again, and me to the camera test. The room was huge and dark, and the art department had put together a makeshift set with a lamp on a table pushed up against the wall about 50 feet from camera. There was a line drawn on the floor for camera to measure distance for the focus puller. They were working quietly, and Emma walked comfortably to and away from camera. In less than 10 minutes, she was off and running to another change. Danielle Rigby, Woody's first AD from Australia, greeted me warmly and invited me in as I waited for a new lighting setup. She brought me over to Woody, who was on his iPhone standing close to the wall away from camera. He asked about my wrist, which was still puffy and stiff, but would be fine for shooting. I would just have to wear my splint between takes. He said I could wear the splint if I needed to, but I assured him I'd be all right. We spoke quietly, as if talking would interfere with the world he was shaping. We spoke in church whispers. His daughter Manzi, who was 12 at the time, came over and introduced herself. She was spirited and lovely and brought me to meet Woody's sister Letty, where they were sitting in director chairs at the video monitor. I put my bag on the back of a chair, and Danielle called me over to meet Darius Kanji, the DP, and his camera crew. Woody came over to have a look at me, alternately folding his arms and clasping his hands as I stood in front of camera. It really did feel like church in there, and the crew worked swiftly and in hushed tones. I made small talk and said something stupid like, "Wow, we're shooting in film." And Woody said something like, "Well, this is a movie," at which I laughed. Alone. I turned around and walked to the mark in the back of the room, feeling like there was toilet paper on the bottom of my shoe, or that my skirt was tucked into my pantyhose. Helen Robin, Woody's longtime producer, had no real time to be a realtor while overseeing production, and actors were given a fee to find their own living accommodations. Emma Stone got a house outside of Newport proper, Joaquin would live in Providence around the college campus, and I found a nice 1800s hovel with no air conditioning or bathtub on the bottom floor of a house just a 10-minute walk from the main part of town, close to the wharf and restaurants. I met up with Joaquin to go over our scenes, and he kept quiet about the reveal of his character, Abe. It turned out Abe was a psychopath, but my character was in love with him, so why tell me about it? He had more on his plate to deal with, like carrying the whole movie. Joaquin had gained like 30 pounds for the part, and we laughed about that, and about how Woody told him not to grow any facial hair or do anything weird when they talked on the phone about working together. Here's something else that's funny about Woody, his strong aversion to blue jeans. He asked Susie what the students would be wearing, and she said blue jeans. "No one wears blue jeans," he said. "Students wear blue jeans," she responded. "No, they don't." And that went on until everyone was in khakis. My first day of work was on the first day of shooting, and I was in the first scene up in the morning, as well as the last scene of the day. It was a 3.5-page scene, which is a standard, if long, scene in any movie. I drove the scene with information from the third part of the film, which I knew nothing about. It took place in a bar, and there were about 100 extras there. On Woody's sets, they call the actors in at the last minute, so there's not too much distraction before we start shooting. I recognized Virginia, his script coordinator, who I'd worked with years ago. She used to be a nun, if you can believe that. I naively thought this was a sign that God was on my side that day, but this would be a day resembling more of a baptism by fire. I was milling about briefly before sitting at the bar with Emma for our scene together. When I sat down, Darius leaned over and asked, whispering, if I could sit facing out, since that was where the light would hit my face in the way he liked. "Sure, of course," I said. Emma would be walking in, and I noticed her and motioned for her to sit with me. After the first take, Woody came over and said, "Are you going to sit like that? Because it looks like you're waiting for the camera to land on you." Hilarious. There isn't much he can say that isn't funny, even if the joke's on you and it's not a joke. I was good-natured and apologized, saying I'd forgotten how to act, that I didn't know how to do this anymore. I wasn't going to say Darius told me to sit here and he's your DP, mostly because it didn't occur to me. I felt stupid and knew there was a chance I'd be fired and replaced, but went with the flow, man. Later, I would read Eric Lax's book about the making of Irrational Man, which talks about this scene and how Woody wanted to cut the introduction when he heard it because he knew it was false once we were rolling. But a big part of being an actor is falling into the projection that a director wants, or being in the director's subjectivity. "Rita's a lonely woman," Woody repeated to me a few times, which wasn't emphasized in the letter. "Lonely woman" has a deeper weight to it than the unhappy marriage he'd mentioned in the letter. We went into the bulk of the scene, the dialogue, and started with a two-shot. Things were going smoothly, and there was good energy in the air. When Emma and I went downstairs, as the lighting was being set up for her coverage, she said Woody liked me, or he wouldn't have been hanging around camera. She gave me an assuring nod, like, "You better believe it, kiddo." Emma is savvy, and she and Woody had a great rapport, like school chums. They caught up between takes with casual, witty banter like Groucho Marx and Ethel Merman. At one point, they were talking dessert, and I chimed in with, "I love meringue," which is true. How can a whipped egg white with a little bit of sugar be that delicious? I might have added if my initial comment hadn't stopped the conversation. I pushed away the thought that meringue could get me fired and thought more of the lonely woman that I was supposed to be. Hitchcock was famous for saying you should treat actors like cattle. But with good directors, I felt more like a horse, since horses are trained with subtlety and instinct, and sometimes deliberate force. I would clomp to lunch like an old mare with Emma, who had the light, steady gallop of a young and beautiful thoroughbred. Joaquin was sitting at the cafeteria table alone, like a sexy beast hovering over his script, which was laid out in front of him. He asked if I was able to sleep. He hadn't, but I had. He was already sweating. It was August and hot out, and I showed him my swollen wrist, which made him wince and cower. I could barely move it up or down, and the heat agitated it. We told him the morning had gone well and that we were moving on to my coverage after lunch. During my coverage, when the cameras turned on me back at the bar, was when it all went to hell in a handbasket. I did 20 takes of the scene, which I've never done in my life. For one line, it was important not to sound definitive, which could imply that Rita knew Abe was a psychopath. It had the words crackpot theory in it, and I couldn't get it to sound the way Woody wanted it to, so he was giving me line readings, which is the biggest blow to an actor's ego. The 100 extras were there, though, to support my meltdown and to witness the greatest living film director's frustration at my performance. At one point, he said I was a terrific actress and a complicated woman, but that he didn't want to see any of that in his movie. I don't know what I felt in that moment. Caught, but liberated into unknown territory. I stared into the eyes of the focus puller, who was an arm's length away, and she smiled to assure me that anything and everything was right in the world. She even gave me a thumbs up. I guess Parker could die a little, and Rita could take over. I'd forget my lines and shout to Virginia to cue me. I was flailing in the water. I remembered how I almost drowned in a wave pool as a kid and got pulled out and coughed up water. Emma's pretty face was gobsmacked and compassionate. She asked if I needed anything from her. I wanted a lobotomy and a tapeworm. My own thoughts sounded like pig Latin, and I felt I'd be smart to find something else to do for a living. But at the present moment, I would not forget I was being directed by Woody Allen. By some miracle, I got the line right in the medium shot, which was met with the relief of a baby being delivered, and I was happy to be moving on. I told Woody I felt like I was being chiropracted. He put his hands in a frame shot in front of my face. "Now we're going in for a close-up, so, you know, don't do too much moving around," he told me. "I think I remember what a close-up is," I said. "We can try a few." It went more smoothly this time around, and he gave me direction from the monitor, like, "Do anything, say what you want," and came over after it was all done and told me which takes he was printing. I'd have to wait for a blue ribbon when I wrapped in 5 weeks. Outside, one of the producers said I reminded him of Sandy Dennis, which was nice of him, and then I got in the van with Emma for the ride back to Holding. My makeup artist knocked on the door of my trailer and asked if I needed a hug. But I said I was fine, which I was, more or less. My hairdresser referred to the ordeal as a brain fart, but I knew it was much more than that. Susie breezed by like Thelma Ritter, the dresser for Betty Davis and All About Eve and The Wisecracker and many old classic movies, saying Woody always freaks out when he starts to hear his dialogue said for the first time and usually reshoots the first day of work anyway. She said a lot of actresses have had meltdowns in their trailers on the first day of work, and she really helped me brush it off further, and besides, I knew what a creative process could be. But also, I couldn't afford to be anxious because I had another scene to do and had to change. It was a little scene in which I fantasized about Joaquin taking me away to travel, to Europe, to London even, anywhere but here. Woody works fast, and I'm like that too, so I wanted to do it right in the first take. The first take is usually the best one. So we did the first take, but the sound was bad, and then we did another take, which I felt was meh. And Woody came over and said, "That was good, the first take. That was the right temperature, but it was bad for sound, so we have to go again." I told him I was good at looping, and he said he didn't like looping, so we'd go again. He emphasized once more that Rita was a lonely woman and in an unhappy marriage. I assured him with a nod. He said, "No smiling," to which I nodded again, smiling. He moves his hands and fingers when he talks, like he's molding invisible space for you to figure out exactly what it is, to communicate some sensitivity, maybe. That's my interpretation, anyway. Before he sat back down at the monitor, he shouted out like an afterthought, "Just make sure your voice doesn't get too soft. You don't want to sound too actressy." It took me aback, and I immediately stood up and took a deep breath like I was going to faint and fake stabbed myself in the stomach, letting out a, "Ugh!" and stuck my tongue out like a dying possum. "That was deliberate," he said quickly and with humor, and I took the fake knife out of my side and put it in the other side and laughed, screamed, "Do it again!" And I knew that moment said we could work together. I went home that night and talked to my analyst on the phone. My wrist was throbbing, and I couldn't even turn a doorknob. In denial, I'd bought food for the fridge and brought my knives from home so I could cook, but it was painful just to place my hand around the strap of my purse as it hung on my shoulder. The most natural thing in real life, and I knew I'd have to carry bags and purses in the scene we were shooting on Friday. What was I going to do? This was in 2014, when the accusation scandal wasn't as hot in the climate of the culture, but I read the articles online about the case and can relate to all the players in the story. I wonder if it will be staged as an opera in 50 years. To each his own. Social media would definitely be the chorus. Or would it be an oracle? We're in choppy air. Fasten your seatbelt. I called Helen the next day to see if she'd ask Woody if I could wear the splint for the rest of the 5 weeks I was working. Since we'd only shot Rita's final scenes, it was conceivable in the storyline. I was anxious and called Joaquin to get his experienced input. He said Woody was a maestro who I had to trust, and he was right. We talked about Charlotte Rampling and Stardust Memories, how open and beautiful she was, and said goodnight. There's a documentary from the Criterion Collection that comes with a DVD of Ingmar Bergman's film Persona, where Liv Ullmann talks about working with him, specifically about his scene with the burning house, where he was screaming at her to get closer to the fire, and she knew that he was talking to her, not the character. They fell in love when she was 25 and he was 46 and had a volatile and creative relationship. He was intensely controlling and went so far as to build a stone wall around their house, only letting her leave on Wednesdays when she'd wash her hair and have a few drinks. But they were dear friends in the end, and they kept working together, even after he married someone else. I think of Claire Bloom's memoir about her relationship with Philip Roth and how she expressed her relationship to acting as annihilating. If I hadn't had a father who was devouring, would I have the ability to devour stories or be devoured by them? Annihilation in order to take shape all over again? I'm turning my light off. To be kept in the dark or in the unknown is to find your way out. You have a more interesting film when you capture characters finding their way. I always loved Nancy Drew, how she tiptoed around those caves with her flashlight, moving carefully forward, listening deeply to her instincts, and finding her way out. Helen called the next day to say it was too late to wear the splint, and I almost started crying, but I played it pretty cool on the phone. It was enough that my hand hurt, but being a difficult actress was the last thing I wanted to carry around. No, that was not the part I was going to play out. She feels trapped. That was another thing Woody emphasized about Rita that first day. It was there in the material, in the cliff scene with Joaquin, where Rita says she feels trapped in her life as a teacher and wants to run away to Spain. I felt trapped by what I did and wanted to run away from it. Maybe that was what Woody saw in me when he cast me, that I was over the hill and at the right age for all those feelings, for that particular realization and dissolving of fantasy, that disillusionment. Like Rita, I wanted to flee so I wouldn't have to face remorse of another life I could have lived. One night that week, before I'd shot any more scenes, I escorted my broken wrist out to dinner on the wharf in Newport, where I met two nice ladies, one with a broken leg, who rode around on a scooter, and her best friend who was joining her. We had a nice dinner at the bar and talked about how compassionate some people were toward someone with an injury. My splint was a great conversation starter. You'd be surprised how many people want to tell you their own horror stories of falls and breaks, and the PT community is full of a bunch of angel people who are wonderful and doing real hands-on healing stuff. We had a great dinner talking about how miraculously the body heals itself and how humbling the journey of an injury can be, how people get others' attention and compassion from relating the stories of their own broken bones and recoveries. Walking out of the place, I spotted Woody and Soon Yi on their way to dinner, and I took off my hat and waved as if they were far out in the ocean and couldn't see me, even though they were just 10 feet away. I think I even jumped up and down. It was fortuitous running into him in real life, and he gave me a tiny smile, and I quickly apologized to him for Monday's work and groveled. Dailies were good, and the close-up was nice, he said. I was relieved and happy that we wouldn't have to reshoot it, and pumped my hands in the air like, yay! I introduced myself to Soon Yi, who wanted to hike the cliffs, and Woody made a gesture like, you two should go together, but then we found out that we couldn't since I had to work and she was leaving town. I told her how bright and sweet Manzi was and mentioned the ocean, how I didn't care for the beach. As my mother would say, all that sand, I said. I explained I felt more like Geraldine Page in Interiors, with moments staring out at the ocean that started with peace but could linger into a foreboding feeling, depending on my mood. Woody and Soon Yi were going to the Pearl for their famous crab cakes. It's clear that they're right for each other. He shooed me away, joking. Don't you have lines to learn for tomorrow? Oh, yes, I have to memorize those lines. Then I walked away, swiftly as directed. The next morning, Joaquin and I were scheduled to shoot a walk and talk outside on the campus. Before the scene, Woody said, in his apologetic manner, what I wrote isn't very good, no. If you'd like to add anything, please do. Say whatever you want. Make it better, more believable than what I wrote. And, you know, what he was saying was, being the reality of this movie he was making. So Joaquin and I did the scene, and afterward, Woody came over and spread his arms out reassuringly between us and said, joking and deliberate, neither of you are getting fired. After I knew I wasn't getting fired, I felt as relaxed and cool with everything as I possibly could. Joaquin would groan loudly in agony and run to Woody to apologize for his performance or ask a question. He was playing a psychopath, and that's a challenging role. Woody reassured him over and over. No, 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 it was very, very good, he'd say. Or, well, for me, it sounded as if people were having a conversation, but, Joaquin would scratch his head and brood. The first week is always hard. But later in the shoot, he said Woody, directing him in a scene, said he didn't have to have so much style, which I thought was very astute. We laughed about it because he'd never thought of himself that way, and it was so obvious. It was a relief having so many scenes with Joaquin where I wouldn't have to be the one torturing myself. I liked that he took up that emotional space. I loved his energy and sensitivity and perfectionism. There was another walk-and-talk scene, and I was feeling comfortable in my work. In the scene, I invited Joaquin's character, Abe, up to my house to smoke some grass. When he passed on that offer, I said, that's cool. Then Woody stopped the take and said, that's terrible, you can't say that. I started groaning and apologizing and shouted back, okay, cool, I won't say it. Teachers don't say cool anymore, Woody thought. But they don't call pot grass either, I could have said, but didn't. Later that day, I asked Woody about the crab cakes from the night before, if they were as good as he'd heard. I mentioned being from the New Orleans area and brought up Galatoire's, a place I grew up going to that also had famous crab cakes. We were getting ready to shoot a short but sensitive scene in the rain with my husband. I'd tell him I was leaving him. I just met the actor playing my husband that day, and he was so tender and bright that my heart was already breaking. Woody said he liked the crab cakes, and I went to the car to film the scene. The scene begins mid-conversation where Rita's mentioned a break from the marriage and her desire to travel, to see other places, she says. She tries to appease both of their feelings by saying, let's just talk about the details. After the first take, Woody scampered over through the fake rain, holding on to his hat. He leaned into the car and said, that was good. It's the right temperature. Now you have 15 minutes to get this right, and then you can have your crab cake. We were done in less than 15 minutes, and I couldn't have my crab cake because the restaurant was closed on Mondays. I'd grown up with sardonic wit with my own father, so I was used to it. When I asked my dad what he thought of Superman Returns, he quipped, at least I wasn't bored. My favorite night of shooting was a scene with Joaquin where Rita knocks on Abe's door with two bottles of whiskey. She says she was in the neighborhood and that she got a bottle for her husband, but she knew how much Abe liked whiskey, so she picked one up for him too. Just a sad, funny bit of dialogue between two lonely grown-ups. Come in, he says, as she's in the room already, and Rita says, I thought you'd never ask. I was nervous before the scene. During rehearsal, Woody stands to watch, like all directors do, but he's Woody Allen, so it's different. A few minutes earlier, Darius had asked me to come in through the awning of the door quickly since it shadowed me, so I did. When Woody watched the scene, he was like, "Why are you in such a rush? I don't understand." I wasn't going to tattle, so I went back to my, "It's because I've never acted before and I don't know what I'm doing" bit, which felt true enough. Better than, "Oh, Darius wanted me to find my light." How lame would that have sounded? Joaquin had to run away to his rented home to rest before we shot, so I couldn't go to him for reassurance or comfort. Plus, he couldn't give me that in the scene either, so he didn't in real life. When we started shooting, the first take was alive and I was the right temperature, Woody said. Joaquin hated it, so we did it again, but it was bad for sound. Woody came to apologize, and then he said, "Just the tiniest bit of irony when you say, 'I thought you'd never ask.' Just the tiniest bit." His hands gesturing in that maestro way, soft in expressing the touch. We did the take, and I heard a groan again, which I didn't know how to interpret. Disdain? Relief? Boredom? The crew started filing out, looking as if they were leaving, which they were. Woody stopped to say, "It's cutting together nicely. We've seen some of the scenes and, as in, yes." I nodded in a way that said, "Good, good, good. Have a nice dinner. Carry on," which he did. I went across the street to visit Tom, one of my friends from high school, who lived just a few doors down from where we were shooting. We sat on the porch belonging to his neighbors and had a beer and watched the crew wrap up location. One time I saw Woody looking at me from about 50 feet away, and I waved my splinted wrist side to side, far away from what felt like a shore, as I stood on the porch. He didn't wave back, so I took it to mean he was in his camera, and so I carried on being the subject, like a character in one of his movies, which I was. But there he was, the progenitor of independent cinema, auteur and actor, around 80 years old now, in his iconic, casually chic weatherman attire, having his freedom to create whatever world he wanted. I had a good relationship with my wrist by this point, and would look at it like it held all my anxieties, leaving the rest of me relaxed. Woody listens with his headphones, maybe as much as he watches. He likes to hear the subtlety of the voice. My final scene was a walk on campus with Joaquin to meet Emma, who tells him some news, a scandal about a judge who's been murdered. At this point, we had slept together, but our relationship had cooled. I had a line to Joaquin before Emma came over that could express withering irony or jealousy. It was maybe 7 words off the cuff, nothing major. In the second take, I stepped back from the pain or jealousy and instead had more irony. After Woody gave notes to Emma and Joaquin, he said to me, "You lost the feeling of that line." And he was right. I'd lost the feeling, and he caught it. Danielle called out, "It's a wrap for Parker," and everyone clapped. Woody came over and put his hands out in a "don't hug me" stance, smiling, saying, "I may have the Ebola virus." The news had come out in the papers that very day. I mirrored him, and he said, "Thank you for your performance. You delivered the lines as I'd heard them and envisioned them, and now your parents will be proud of you." I laughed really hard at that one. Who in show business believes their parents are proud of them? I never did, and fight to believe it. It's an industry, an art hopefully, full of orphans left to create their own worlds with one another. I don't feel glamorous. I feel like a possum, the animal born clinging to its mother's tail that grows up by falling off it, and probably too soon, acting as the possum's defense. Have you ever seen this? When threatened, they play dead, and they're very convincing at it. They scare themselves so deeply that their eyes roll back into their heads and their little tongues stick out. They'll even take it as far as to froth at the mouth. They'll go on with the act as long as they're terrified. And it's truly ghoulish, because they've been known to be buried alive. They're famous for it. Anyway, we celebrated at Cannes, where the movie premiered. Here's another serendipitous thing. On the drive to the Croisette, where the festival is held, the woman on the Irrational Man press team sat in front with the driver and said I lived in her sister's old apartment. I got to ask her sister if it was true that the great guitar player Jorma Kaukonen built the closet there, and he had. I hadn't been to Cannes in 20 years. I'd had some independent movies there in the 90s, back when invitations were on paper, and there was dancing. I danced with Chris Isaak. For the red carpet, I wore a